Welcome to the Center for Spiritual Living Santa Rosa, a spiritual community that promotes global transformation through personal transformation. At the center, we are motivated by a compelling vision of a healthy, loving world, which we call the Global Heart Vision. This vision inspires us to bring the gifts of compassion and loving kindness to the world through our ministries and teaching. What you are about to hear is a recording of a message delivered at the Center for Spiritual Living Santa Rosa. Feel welcomed. Feel at home.
Much, Mr. Christopher Fritchie and the gentlemen of the band, and I'm going to invite you to walk the razor's edge and turn around and welcome somebody. Let no person go unwelcomed.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Good morning. This morning, our affirmation is right up here if you read it with me. I seek the common good. And our topic for today is relaxing and settling the mind. And 2 weeks ago, as I told you, it was the Jewish festival of Purim. And this month is Women's History Month. So I'm going to tell you a story from the Bible that connects all of this. It's big. It's a big story, so you're going to have to listen fast. It goes like this. It's all going to work out anyway, no matter what you decide to do. That's what Mordecai said to Esther when he was sending her out to save a nation, and she hesitated. Now, you may not know what I'm talking about unless you grew up in a Jewish background. Then you would know that I'm talking about one of the most beloved stories of the Jewish tradition, Purim. It comes from the book of Esther, and it's a story about difficult choices, betrayal, courage, rampant ego, seeking the common good, and also settling the mind before acting. I told you. And here's my version of the story as best as I know it. Picture the scene. A long time ago, once upon a time, many thousands of years ago, the Persians ruled everything. Everything. The entire world. More than any superpower before them. The Persian king, whose name is impossible, you know. His name is, we call him Xerxes, you know. It's Akashverosh or Ahasuerus. Let's just call him the king. Okay, the king, very powerful man. And he governed an empire that stretched all the way from India through to Ethiopia. Huge. And we come into the story at a time when he was hosting an event for all of the important people of all of the kingdom, political networking. And mind you, it was something like 180 days long, this event. And then followed by a seven-day feast for the key leaders of the different nations. He must have been a religious scientist. Party, you know. Anyway, his wife, Queen Vashti, who is, it's complicated. She's remembered as both a villain because of the way she treated people in her household, but also as a kind of hero because with a single act of defiance, she caused every woman to ask the question that we still ask today. Why, in the most powerful nation on the earth, do we treat women the way we do? And here's how it happened. You see, she was busy holding her own festival for the women of the kingdom who weren't allowed to party with the men. And when what happened was, it says it in the book properly, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. You know what that means? Blotto. Drunk. He calls for the queen to appear. And he calls for the queen to appear wearing her crown only. Not only does he want to show off the wealth of the kingdom, but he also wants to show off her beauty. You know, he could have commanded her to come. He could have sent guards to drag her in, but he needed her to be obedient to show his dominance and power. But Queen Vashti declined to come. Isn't that great? She said no. No, he gets so mad because he doesn't know what to do. I mean, he's never had to deal with this before. He has never had to deal with no. It doesn't fit in to his worldview. Nothing prepared him for this. There's nothing in the How to Be a King manual that prepares him for this. You know, in fact, there's nothing even in the laws of the land that prepare him to deal with her. So he calls all of the lawmakers, men, together to ask what to do. And one man says, you know, this is very serious. I mean, because not only has Queen Vashti done the king wrong, she has also wronged all of the men of the kingdom. Because now, all the women watching her, it will cause them to look with contempt upon their husbands and disobey them. Something must be done. Wow. You know, it made me think. Thinking of Vashti saying no made me think of a science of mind teaching that says, you know, when one person remembers and knows their power, everyone is impacted. The ripple effect, the trickle-up method. When one person shakingly says no to injustice, it emboldens everyone somehow, even if it takes centuries. Anyway, the lawmakers give some advice to the king. They say, you know what you got to do? You have to write a law. Make a law. Say in the law that Vashti, the queen, can no longer come before the king, which means she can no longer be intimate with him. She can no longer. She's probably thrilled. You know. So he makes the rule, you know. And sadly, that's the end of Queen Vashti as we know it. The hero and the villain at the same time. You know, hero, because she was defiant in the face of oppression, and she refused to comply with an unjust law. You know, as I was thinking about this yesterday, I read about the Kingdom of Brunei. Passing a law goes into law on Wednesday coming, saying that adulterous women and homosexuals may be stoned to death. Yeah. And I'm thinking, too, about in Saudi Arabia, where male guardianship is still a thing, and it severely limits women's freedoms, and how women activists saying no are thrown into prison. You know. And so I thought about this. To refuse to obey an unjust law is exactly what Queen Vashti did. So in a way, she was the precursor of civil disobedience. It's complicated because she was also considered to be a villain. You know why? Because she treated the Jewish girls in her household the same way that the king treated her. Ooh. It's a solemn reminder for me to extend the dignity I wish for myself to others, because no one is above the spiritual law of cause and effect. Important side note here. The king, he made a law that she can't approach him anymore. In those days, the king's laws cannot be revoked. His word, once given, is considered permanent, final. I was thinking about that. Imagine when you and I, when we're praying and we're saying our affirmations, if we thought of the words that came out of our mouth with that weight, right? Oh, it would give that phrase, and so it is, a whole new meaning. You know? Whew. Anyway, he's got to replace the queen now. So he has what I guess you could say in the most polite way is an international beauty contest. You know, the ancient Persian version of Miss America pageant. And that's where we get to meet two new characters. First of all, Mordecai, and then second, Esther. There's a relationship between the two of them. Esther's an orphan, and I think she's the daughter of Mordecai's uncle. So I'm going to call him a cousin. The important thing to note is that according to Jewish law, widows and orphans must be taken in and cared for by the next of kin forever, no matter what. So he's kind of like her protector and wants the best for her, even though he goes about it in a curious way. And even though the Jews were scattered during the Babylonian rule before the Persians, they remained devout and practiced their faith. And such a man was Mordecai, and such a woman was Esther. So he sees the opportunity for her in the international beauty pageant, and he sends her off to participate. But he advises her to not make it known that she's Jewish. Why? Well, they were a captured people, and he didn't want her to be compromised, even though he himself was out as a Jew. Curious. Anyway, the women of the kingdom have a year to prepare for the pageant, and each woman participating is granted, you can take anything with you that would enhance your opportunity to be chosen as the queen. And here's where we get the insight into Esther, because she knew who she was. She had a sense of self. And she said, I will go as I am, taking nothing with her, nothing to add on, just her sense of self. And you just know how this is going to turn out. The king falls in love with her and makes her queen. This is where we sigh. And it came to pass that Mordecai, cousin Mordecai, was a minor official in the court at the time. And he overheard two other officials plotting to kill the king. So he tells Esther and sends the message to the king, who successfully interrupts the assassination. The king is delighted, and he makes a record of it in the book of records. I think of it kind of like his journal. You know, he's processing what happened today. Today, I was warned by Mordecai, and I stopped the assassination. He's thrilled. He writes it in the book, and he closes it. And they would have all lived happily ever after, except for, if it hadn't been for Haman, the villain. It's a high court official, the vizier in those days. And he is so pumped up with ego and pride that he causes everybody to bow down to him as he walks past. Which, of course, Mordecai refuses to do. We've got a new dynamic. Mordecai and Haman. Uh-oh. I mean, look, Mordecai couldn't bow down to him. It's the first law of Judaism. You know, bow down to anything other than the divine. But there's another reason. There's bad blood there. You see, Haman is an Agagite. That's hard to explain, but I'll tell you what it means. There was a long and tragic history of mutual aggression between that nation and the people of Israel. Bad blood, a grudge. Anyway, so Haman notices Mordecai won't bow down, and it really bugs him. And he's festering on his own. I'm not just going to get rid of Mordecai. I'm going to get rid of every Jew. And this is his plan. He goes to the king and he says, King, did you know that there are a people among your people scattered across the provinces who have their own ways and their own laws which they hold above your laws? Did you know that? And the king's like, oh, probably lots of people. Haman says, they don't obey you. And he says, well, I know what. We should get rid of them. Okay. He said, I'll fund it. He bribes the king. He says, I will deposit into the royal coffers a huge amount that will compensate for anything that... And the king's like, oh, now he's interested. And so Haman says, you should put out a decree. I will implement it. And the decree is put out. And the decree is that on such and such a date, all and any Jews may be murdered. And as an added incentive, their property may be taken. And it's sent to every corner of the world. Quick recap. Are you still with me? Okay. A decree by the king cannot be revoked. Second, Queen Esther didn't tell anybody that she is Jewish. Third, now everybody is super excited about land acquisition through murder. Unless you're Jewish. What now? Well, Mordecai sends a copy of the edict to Esther with a note saying, go to the king and beg for mercy. And she writes back to him very politely saying, you know, all of the king's servants know you can't just walk into the audience room without being called upon. And I have not been sent for in 30 days. And if I go in without a summons, it's instant death because in the gallery above the room, there are archers. I can't do that. And Mordecai returns to her what is fondly known as a pat on the back and a kick in the pants. First, the kick. He says, don't imagine that because you're in the palace that you alone of all the Jews will escape. Two, the threat. Well, that's the threat. Here's the pat on the back. This is good. If you remain silent, it'll all work out anyway because help will arise from somewhere else, although you might perish. So it's kind of a pat slap. And then the challenge, and he says, who knows whether you have come to this royal position for such a time as this? And that's when her heart changed. You see, the call to higher consciousness is what changed her heart. And she wrote back. She said, go. Assemble all the Jews together, all of them who are in the town, and have them fast with me and pray with me. And then I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Oh, I love that part of the story. Gives me goosebumps. You know, maybe I have the privilege I have so that I can do what I can do for the world. And it's almost as if her life prepared her for that. Almost as if. you know, maybe you too. Think about what you and I can do for this world because of the position and the privilege that we have. Think of the good that we can do that others cannot do for themselves. So she decides to do her spiritual work first. Key point. She does her spiritual work first, and I love that she asked for support from her spiritual community. She asked for them to fast and pray with her. And that's symbolic of suspending everything else and turning our attention to the divine before acting. You know, it reminds me every month on the last day of the month, a group of meditators gather here at the center to contemplate, to suspend everything and turn their attention to the divine for the benefit of all beings. And since today is the last day of the month, it's tonight. And you're invited to attend a special world peace meditation at 7 p.m. Now, I said I love that she does her spiritual work first before she does anything else. Because you know what I do? I act first. Then I pray afterwards to correct the mess I made. Do you do that? I'll get into trouble, then I will contemplate. I'm learning. And by the way, she didn't say, like I will often say, she didn't say, I will do my prayer work and that will assure success. She didn't say that. She didn't say, I will pray first and then I will go in knowing I can't perish. No, she didn't say that. She did not say, if I pray, I will get what I want. She didn't say that. No, she prayed for the courage and the strength to walk the razor's edge and to do what was hers to do, even though the outcome was uncertain, to say the most. Have you ever felt like that? You know you've got to do something. There's a thing you got to do and you're willing to do it. It's just that it's frightening to do it, you know. And you'd love a little assurance, a guarantee, a memo from the divine, you know. And we try to control the outcome, you know. When what we ought to do, I'm thinking, is to suspend everything and pray for the courage and the strength to do the right thing. Then after she prayed and meditated, she was ready and she was all prayed up. And it says in the book, she put on her royal robes, and that is a symbol. She stepped into her outer authority. And she headed for the inner court, the hall of 100 pillars. She knew she was putting her life on the line, you know. Now, by the way, the passage, the one and only passage that led to the throne room was lined end to end with idols. You know, they represent the temptations that disturb us and distract us, cause us to doubt. And as she's walking past all these idols, it whittles down her resolve. She starts to doubt. She's walking, looking at each one, trying not to pay attention. And when she gets to the door, she says the words that so many Christians and Jews know at this time of the year, both for Queen Esther and for Jesus of Nazareth, from Psalm 22. In that moment of pure self-doubt, she says, my God, why have you forsaken me? I know that place. Do you know that place? You know, you're dealing with something big. And the stakes are high, and you know you've got to face it, and you've got your prayer on, and you've put on your royal robes, and you walk right up to the door, and that's the moment when you realize that's not the end, it's just the beginning. More courage is required just when I thought I was empty. Now picture the scene in the audience room, the throne room of the king. In the balcony are hundreds of archers, because they know nobody can approach the king. Indeed, there is a line, a point of no return. If somebody crosses it, they die. And she walks. As she approaches it, the archers start to lift up their bows and arrows. And she approaches it, and everybody's wondering what will happen. And as she is about to take the final step over that line, out of the corner of his eye, as if he's not even paying attention, the king raises his golden scepter to halt them and says, "My queen, what is your petition? For surely, even if it cost as much as half of the kingdom, I will grant it." And you can feel everybody go, "Ah." And the archers put down their bow and arrow. And she says, "My lord, it would be my pleasure to invite you to lunch, where I will tell you what my petition is. And by the way, bring Haman with you." Now, Haman's standing right there. He's delighted. He thinks he's made it. He's so excited. Oh, he's puffed up. He's arrived. You know, when the ego mistakenly identifies itself as the center of the universe. Oh, I had an instance of that in my own life when I was a brand new minister. I was new in town, and I was so happy to be in a thriving community. I went shopping at a supermarket. I'm standing at the produce stand there, and somebody just a few stands down, goes, and I was like, "Oh, hello, you recognize me?" And she goes, "No, not you." She's waving at her friend. Oh my goodness, when the ego mistakenly identifies itself as the center of the universe. Haman, oh man, he was ecstatic, and he goes home to his wife and says, "I could be so happy right now if it just wasn't for Mordecai. I hate him." And the wife says, "Come on, don't worry about it. Look, you know about the edict on such and such a day, all the Jews are going to die anyway. Why don't you build a gallows, put Mordecai's name on it, and then on that day you can hang him yourself?" He says, "Great idea." Great. And he builds it, builds a gallows. It's not the only time Haman's ego ran away with itself, you know, mistakenly identifying him as amazing, you know. I'll tell you another one. One night, the king is sitting around. He can't sleep. And so he calls for the book of Chronicles. Remember his journal? Remember what he wrote down in the journal? Oh, when Mordecai warned him. Remember all of that? And he's reading that, "Mordecai warned me about the assassination." And he says to his attendants, "What was done to reward Mordecai?" And they go, "Nothing." He's, "Nothing? That's ridiculous. We have to correct that. What shall we do about that?" And he says, "You know who would know? Haman would know." So he says, "Is Haman still in the palace?" They say, "Yeah." So they call Haman, and the king says to Haman, "Haman, what should be done for the one man that the king wishes to honor?" Haman thinks it's him. He's ecstatic. So he just lays. He says, "You know what you should do? You should get him clothing that the king has worn and dress him up in it. You should put a crown on his head. You should put him on the king's favorite horse. And you should parade him all over the town so people can see the favor with which the king observes him." And the king says, "You're right. Make it so." And he makes Haman do that for Mordecai. Anyway, let's fast forward to the lunch date with the queen. There's the king and Haman, and they're dining with the queen. And the king says, "Queen Esther, what is your petition?" And she says, "My petition is my life. Because it has been decreed that me and all of my people shall be killed on a certain date. And it all comes flooding into the king, what has happened. Like a download of awareness, and he is furious. He's been tricked, he thinks. And he gets up for a moment to maintain his composure. He steps out on the balcony. And while he's there, Haman realizes he better do something. So he throws himself at the feet of the queen, at which point the king returns and sees him and says, "What, and now you're molesting the queen?" And the guards drag him off. And what do you think they do with him? They hang him on the gallows he prepared for Mordecai. Cause and effect, you know. Not the end. Because what about the king's decree? Remember, it cannot be revoked. What's he going to do? He issues another one. He issues another decree informing the world that all the Jews of the kingdom on a certain day are empowered to defend themselves with whatever means they may have. In other words, sending a strong message to the kingdom that the king has changed his mind. Now, each story is filled up with characters that live in us. That's really the point of it. In you and me, Haman could be acting out at any moment, seeking glory at the expense of others, wrongly identifying ourselves as the center of the universe. Mordecai could be out and about, planning, scheming, sometimes manipulating, controlling things from behind the scenes. And sometimes the king, like a spoiled brat, not able to deal with no. But also within us is Queen Vashti, when, despite our own failings, we are still unwilling to buckle to injustice. And within us also is Queen Esther, when, despite our fears, we act with courage on behalf of those who cannot do so for themselves. And now let us pray. I invite you to breathe in and exhale. In the infinity of life where I am, all is filled to the brim with the awareness of divinity. I salute that awareness. I acknowledge it and give thanks for it. And so it is. It is time for our offering. I invite the ushers to stand. Won't you please say with me, I bless this gift. I send it forth to heal and prosper. It does amazing work in the world. And so it is. Ushers, please receive the gift.